the lovely sound of Bill Evans. Just one of the many musicians photographed by Kathy Sloan at Keystone Corner, a San Francisco jazz club. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Keystone Corner closed its doors in the early 80s, and there's not been a club like it since. Kathy Sloan, who truly honed her art and craft as a photographer in the dim light and raw energy of Keystone Corner, has brought her photographs of the musicians who played there, along with the recollections of many of the folks who were part of the scene there, into her book, Keystone Corner, Portrait of a Jazz Club. Our guest host today is jazz historian and Sonoma County's own jazz MD, Larry Slater, who talks with Sloan about her days at Keystone, her life as a photographer, and the making of this beautiful book. Later in the broadcast, Larry talks with novelist and jazz drummer Bill Moody, whose novels Bird Lives, Looking for Chet Baker, and Fade to Blue all involve a crime-solving pianist, Evan Horn. Author Bill Moody joins Jazz MD, longtime host of KRCB's Jazz Connections, Larry Slater, in conversation about jazz and the improvisation of writing. Throughout the show, we'll listen to music recorded at Keystone Corner. So stay with us. It's a novel idea.
Good evening, I'm Larry Slater, Sonoma County's Jazz MD, and my guest is Kathy Sloan, a Bay Area photographer who has just published a book titled Keystone Corner, Portrait of a Jazz Club. I spent many a joyful hour at Keystone, so I was delighted to find Kathy's book that so vividly brings the psychedelic jazz club to life. Kathy, welcome to Sonoma County, which has its own thriving jazz scene.
Thank you, Larry. It's really nice to be here today. It's a beautiful day.
Kathy, tell us a little bit about Keystone Corner, the jazz club in North Beach that's the focus of your book.
Well, Keystone Corner was really a little hole in the wall. It was pretty small. People, when it was full, were jammed in on long tables that were kind of like on sawhorses with bentwood chairs to sit in, which were remarkably uncomfortable. But the buzz in there was always very high. There was a lot of energy. The waitresses had a hard row to hoe because they'd have to, you know, kind of shimmy in and hand drinks down the tables. It had a small stage, but could hold a big band. And I haven't found a club since that I like as much.
Yeah, I remember going to Keystone. I was a patron at the time. And what I remember is being incredibly uncomfortable, the room being completely full of cigarette smoke, right, and nothing starting within an hour of its designated time.
Oh, that sometimes happened. But it was also what made it such a wonderful place for musicians because it was not a corporate jazz club.
Exactly. When Yoshi's opened, I felt like this isn't a jazz club. It's way too comfortable.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, Keystone was what it was. I mean, it had the greatest music. It has It had the greatest musicians.
It did.
And it did have a special vibe. It just wasn't comfortable.
No, it wasn't comfortable, and everybody talks about that. The other thing, though, about it was that it had the greatest musicians, and it had a very eclectic palette of musicians. So even though Todd really was a bebop man in his heart.
Todd Barkin, the owner of the club.
Exactly, sorry. There were musicians across the spectrum, and that made it really interesting.
Yeah, I've talked to people who went to Keystone in its heyday, and they would say they often wouldn't even look to see who was on the marquee. They would just know that it was going to be interesting and it was going to be good music and it would expand their horizons and they would just go to listen.
Right.
Kathy, tell us a little bit about you. How did you choose to become a photographer, and why jazz as your focus?
Well, I chose to become a photographer because I had a daughter who was a severe asthmatic, and I was a teacher. And I had moved to the Bay Area from New York, and I was teaching high school dropouts. I was teaching returning Vietnam vets at San Francisco State who wanted to go to school full-time and needed to brush up. But I was missing a lot of work because of my daughter, and I moved next door to some people who had a dark room and nowhere to put it. And I had an extra bedroom that really needed a roommate to help pay the rent. But I opted for the dark room, and I had been doing a little bit of photography, and people kept saying, you know, you should pursue this. You have a good eye. So I taught myself photography, and I had a friend who was a musician, Bob Bray, who was a drummer, who took me to Keystone for the first time in 1976. And as soon as I walked into the room, I heard the civil rights movement, and I had been involved as a teacher. And I thought, this is the sound of what that freedom movement was about. I want to take pictures of the musicians.
You talk in the book a little bit about how difficult it was to work at Keystone because the lighting was crummy and it was crowded and there wasn't really room for you to move around. What kind of a reception did you get from Todd Barkin and from the musicians?
Bob Bray introduced me to Todd the second time we went there, which was, I remember, to hear Elvin Jones. And Bob was a pretty assertive character, and he said, you should just let her come here and photograph and not charge her. And Todd said, okay, all you have to do is give me a print of the musicians you photograph every time you come. And that worked for me. It was because they had a kitchen, children could come, so I could bring my daughter. And she would sleep in the back room, or she'd stand up front with the ticket people and help take tickets. And she was very welcomed. The musicians, I approached each time a new musician came to town and asked permission to make photographs. And I think they were so startled that they were being asked that nobody ever said no. So I would come back. I would go on Tuesday when they opened, and I would listen, because I can't listen and photograph at the same time. That's two different kinds of focus, so to speak. So I would listen. I'd come on Thursday and photograph, and on Sunday I would return with a print for each of the musicians and one for Todd. So I didn't want to rip off the musicians. I knew that history.
Yeah, that's a great story. Did you have any jazz photography role models? Were you aware of William Claxton or William Gottlieb or Herman Leonard, the people who had really made a name for themselves as jazz photographers?
I really had not a clue. Huh. I was just beginning to photograph. That's where I learned how to photograph, in the dark with, as you said, terrible lighting. And so it was like my school. I learned what light did on film and how I might have thought that a musician in a spotlight with a hat on his head, I could see his face. Well, when I looked at the film, his face was gone because the hat was shading it. So I learned all of that there. And I was more interested in discovering this art form myself and didn't look at jazz photographers until many years later. However, I had looked at other photographers. One of my favorites was W. Eugene Smith, who you might be interested in, Larry, because he did a wonderful photo essay for Life magazine on the country doctor. And I also came to adore Roy DiCarava, who is also a magnificent photographer, and then later on learned about the others. There's a book, by the way, that came out at the same time mine did about the confluence of jazz and photography, and it's called Blue Notes in Black and White, and it's by a man named Ben Cawthra, C-A-W-T-H-R-A. It's a brilliant look at jazz photography in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and how the jazz and photography grew together through places like Life magazine.
There is something about jazz that makes it photogenic. I've never quite figured what that is. In the old days, it was always the cigarette smoke, right?
Right.
Framed by the horn or by the vocalist.
I think it's the passion and the intensity of the look of musicians, because actually that's the only art form where there's no eraser. You know, you can't undo what you just played. It's all improvisational. And I was very taken with that idea that somebody could stand up there and create on the spot, in the moment.
That's what makes it jazz.
That's what makes it jazz.
Keystone operated from 1972, I believe, when Todd Barkin bought the club, and then closed in 1983. So I was surprised to see your book all these many years later about this club that was such a part of the Bay Area scene at the time. Why now? What was the genesis of the idea?
Well, part of the genesis of the idea was that I had continued to be a freelance photographer since then. And I decided not to make jazz as a way of making a living. So I'd gone on and I had done almost entirely work that came out of nonprofit organizations hiring me. And I have a wonderful archive of Bay Area life, schools, community centers, hospitals. I did a lot in Children's Hospital. In those days, you could go take pictures there. Now, they won't even let you in the door with a camera. And so it became time for me when I did this. I started it in 2005. To be an archaeologist in my archives and start bringing together bodies of work. And somebody said to me, why don't you do a book of jazz photographs? And I said, there are a lot of books of jazz photographs. I need something, a hook. And he said to me, well, what about Keystone Corner? And this light bulb went off. And I keep very good records, so I went back and I pulled all my Keystone negatives and I proof sheets, and I looked through them three times, and I picked out the best ones. When I looked at them, I said, okay, this is fine, but the story is not full enough just with pictures. And I knew that I wanted Al Young to write the introduction, but really I wanted him to write the text. And I approached him because I know him, and he had just become Poet Laureate of California, and he said, no way I can do this now. So I said, okay, maybe I should go interview people who were involved with the club. And that's how that part came. So I started out, my first interview was Eddie Marshall, who I had kept in touch with all these years. And I went to his house and I interviewed him, and Laurie Antonioli just happened to be there, so I interviewed her. And then I developed a list of people that I knew would talk to me, and then they also suggested other people.
And what I really loved about the book is that not only do you have musician interviews, but there's interviews with the sound guy and the cook and the bouncer. How did you find all those people?
Okay, how did I find them? The Aura Harris, who was the cook, I had lost touch with her, but Terry Hinty, I believe. Yes, Terry Hinty put me in touch with her. Terry Hinty also suggested the guy who was the sound guy, and he at that point was the archivist for Fantasy Records, which had the archives of Keystone. So I had him. Devorah Major was also a poet laureate of San Francisco. I had known her since she was a child. Her father and I were very good friends. So I wanted this cross-section. I didn't want just musicians. In terms of musicians, what I would do was for the ones I didn't know well, when they came to town to play, I would call the club or the hotel and see if they would do an interview with me. I wanted to do Ron Carter, for instance, but he didn't return my phone call. But other people, Eddie Henderson who I'd known back in the day, but he was now in New York. He agreed to meet me when he was playing at Yoshi's. Dave Liebman and I met in a restaurant near Yoshi's. Let me just say that there are four people in the book who each have their own chapters. And they have their own chapters because they were good talkers. And I thought what they had to say was interesting. Jack Hirschman had also been a poet laureate in San Francisco. And he had been dating one of the waitresses at Keystone when we were there. And I knew him from then, although I would see him occasionally after that. And he met me outside the Cafe Trieste in San Francisco, which, for those people in San Francisco, know it's on an incredibly busy corner. And I had an old tape recorder, a cassette tape recorder. Deck, huh? And we set it out on the street. And, of course, everybody who walked by had to stop and talk to Jack. So it was a very noisy background, but luckily it's only being transcribed. And Jack is a poet, and Jack had spent a lot of time at Keystone and had wonderful connections to make between art and the music and how jazz had inflected his writing. And so he got a chapter. Aura Harris, who was a cook there, also was a wonderful storyteller. And she had met Todd through Rahsaan, and, you know, Rahsaan was Todd's inspiration.
Rahsaan Roland Kirk.
Right. And then, of course, Todd had his own chapter because it was his club, Todd Barkin. And he had, you know, the history to tell of how it came to be and how he thought about it and the problems he had. He had all of that. So they each had their own chapter. And then Orrin Keepnews is a very well-known producer of jazz records, and he goes back to New York days.
Yeah, Orrin was the original owner of Riverside.
Exactly.
Those Sonny Rollins and Thelonious Monk records.
Exactly. So he was very generous. He came to my studio, and we talked for a long time. And then I had all these interviews, and I still didn't have a shape to the book. I didn't have any budget. Nobody was coming to me with sacks full of money and saying, let me help you. I didn't have a publisher yet. And so I had to do the transcribing, which turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because as I was listening and writing, certain themes seemed to rise up to the top, like, you know, when you used to buy bottles of milk with cream on top, showing my age. There they were. And I said, oh, I could do this by making it like a conversation between people who are not in the same room. And we could talk about different themes. So it all fell into mm-hmm. place, and I was able to move paragraphs around, keeping the voice. Keeping the voice was the most interesting and the most challenging part, so everybody didn't sound flattened out. So that's how the book came to be. And then Al Young at that point said, okay, I will write a preface to the book, an introduction, but you should get in touch with a man named Sasha Feinstein, who might be interested in publishing a piece of this. Well, Sasha Feinstein is one of the more remarkable human beings in this world, who teaches at a college in the middle of Pennsylvania called Lycoming. And he puts out and had been editing a journal called Brilliant Corners, which is a journal of jazz and literature. So I got in touch with him. I sent him some photographs. He loved them. He said, okay, I want to publish some of these with your introduction to the book. Well, I hadn't written my introduction yet because that, of course, was the hard part. But I spent the summer writing it, and I sent it to him, and he published a section of the book. And I said, would you like to edit this book? And he said, no. That was unequivocal. Thank you, but I have enough to do. But I nagged him for about 8 months, and he finally said yes. And that was a wonderful working relationship. He got what I was doing. He does interviews for his magazine, so he could see how close we were in our aesthetic.
You talked about the musicians were pretty open about giving you interviews. But I did notice that there were some very prominent musicians who played at Keystone who are alive today who are not in the book. And I just have to ask why Wynton Marsalis is not in the book, and Pharoah Sanders, who actually lives in Oakland, is not in the book. McCoy Tyner isn't in the book. Why weren't they in the book?
Wynton Marsalis wasn't in the book because there's enough Wynton Marsalis out there in the world, and I really wanted to bring in other people. And that's not to say I don't like Wynton Marsalis. It was just, you know, there's a lot of Wynton Marsalis in the world. I would have loved to have done Pharoah, who I actually do know and had worked with. I don't know if you remember Teresa Records. Teresa Records was a small label in Oakland that was owned by Alan Pittman and Betty Ishida. And I had done a lot of work with Pharoah because they recorded him. But Pharoah is not a talker. And I couldn't imagine trying to interview him and drag. I mean, he plays beautifully, and that's the way he speaks to the world. He's not a talker.
Tell me about the relationship with some of the musicians. Did you get to be friends with some of them?
I did.
I mean, some of the greatest artists of our time were there, Bill Evans and Dexter Gordon and Rahsaan, of course. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your relationship with them.
Okay, I didn't have relationships with them. I had cordial meetings when I was there. They didn't have any problem with me photographing. But I was a bit intimidated by them. You know, I mean, these were really larger than life in my life.
They're the giants.
They're the giants. But when I first met Art Blakey, he was the first musician I met who turned to me and said, "And what do you do other than, you know, take pictures of us?" And I was so taken by that that I immediately invited him to come for dinner. And I lived in a small house in North Oakland. I had, you know, a kitchen table and some chairs and maybe a little couch. But he said yes. And he came to my house. There's a photo at the end of this book of him with my daughter Aisha sitting on his lap playing her violin for him. She was 7 at the time. And we had a wonderful time. And afterwards, he said to me, "You know, you're the only American who ever invited me home for dinner. All over Europe, Asia, people invite you home. You're the first." I don't know that I believed it, but it was part of his sweetness. And one of the things we discovered about each other is that we were both avid readers. And so whenever he'd come to town, we'd talk about what we were reading, what literature we were into. And what he said he wanted to do was take my daughter to his home in Long Island so that I could be in New York, where I needed to be to make my art grow. And I said that was very sweet, but no, he couldn't have my daughter. And, you know, we remained friends until the end. He was such a generous human being.
Wow, what a sweet story. And how about Todd? I mean, when you first approached Todd Barkin, mm-hmm. the owner and really the soul of the club. Mm-hmm. What was Todd's reaction to you writing a book, and how much input did he want, and did he want editorial control in the book?
Yes and yes and yes. When I first approached him, I called him from here and I was going to New York to interview people, and he said, "Okay." And we made a date to meet at Dizzy's, where he was the artistic director. And he said, "You know, I've been writing my autobiography for 30 years, working on it, and I don't want to give you these stories." And so I said, "Well, I'm not writing a biography of you. I'm writing a biography of the place." And he said, "Well, I don't know. Let me comp you for the night." I said, "No, no, let's talk about this interview." So after a fairly long conversation, he said, "Okay, come back next week and I'll do an interview with you." So we did a great interview. He did a really good interview.
I mean, most people in the book were very complimentary of Todd.
Oh, it was but a not love everybody. Song.
But not everybody.
Almost everybody.
Almost everybody.
Eddie Henderson was not.
Eddie Henderson was not. And Orrin Keepnews. Yeah, Orrin Keepnews, again, the fellow who was one of jazz's legendary record producers, compared him to Max Gordon, who was the owner and proprietor of the Village Vanguard. And I think his comment was, "He ain't no Max Gordon."
It's true. And I have to say, though, Aaron was very critical of Todd as a businessman.
Yeah.
But for every sentence he said of Todd being the worst businessman in the world, he said, but you can't fault his taste and you can't fault the way he treated musicians. So, you know, it was hot and cold. But mostly, and I didn't plan it this way because I didn't know what people would say, I think it was a love song to Todd.
I really enjoyed that chapter. I thought it was one of the most entertaining parts of the book, mostly because he's so outspoken.
So frank,
he
yes.
He is very frank. The book contains a CD.
Yeah.
There were a number of recordings from Keystone. Mm-hmm. Apparently some were planned, some were not. Your book mentions that there was a tape rolling at all times, and some of the recording quality was terrible, mm-hmm. and some of it was wonderful, but mm-hmm. there was always a tape rolling somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so of the many Keystone recordings that are out, there are variable
quality
audio quality. Mm-hmm. As an amateur jazz historian myself, I loved the back two pages of the book where you listed every single recording from Keystone. I love that. How did you compile that?
Also, that was a gift, too. Stuart Kremski, as I said, was the archivist of Fantasy. And when I went to interview him, he actually offered to do a discography for me.
Do you still have a connection to the jazz world, Kathy? Do you go to hear jazz? Are you photographing jazz musicians today?
I do it occasionally. I don't have the same relationships with any clubs. After Keystone closed, even during Keystone, actually, I had a good relationship with Tom Bradshaw at Great American Music Hall. He also let me come in and photograph. I did some at Yoshi's, but it was too big and I was too far away. And I, as you can tell from my photographs, I like to be in the music. Now, if I go to Yoshi's and a friend of mine is playing there, I don't know, let's say Oliver Lake is playing there, and I go to go backstage to say hello, there's some guy in a suit who greets me at the door, and he says, you can't go in, and I don't know you. And
it's a different world.
It's a very different world.
One last comment. This is a photography question, Kathy. To me, the black and white photographs speak to me, and the color photographs do not.
Me too. Color is so seductive that if you have color, then the forms and the shapes and the faces get subsumed by the color. And so I shot in black and white, except for clients who insisted on color, until I went digital. And that now I will shoot in color and transfer it to black and white. I much prefer black and white.
I feel the same way. Kathy, if you could go in your time machine and you could go back to Keystone, mm-hmm. is there a particular artist or event or gig that you would want to sit in on that you missed?
Yeah, I would like to have sat in on Miles Davis, which I missed. He played there before I got there. There's one night that I was there that was pretty spectacular. Arthur Blythe was playing with tuba player Bob Stewart, and I had met Bob earlier, and the day of the concert, I took him up north to Bodega Bay and driving back, and when we got back, I played him a very favorite recording of mine, which is Archie Shepp and Horace Parlin playing gospel music. And, you know, then I took him back to the club, and I went that night to hear him, and I walked in the club, and they were playing all the way out. I mean, they were in the stratosphere. And I stood in the door for a minute because I didn't want to break that. And as I was standing there, Bob played a solo of Motherless Child, which I had played for him that afternoon. And I guess he saw me come in because, you know, it was pretty dark. I just stood there, and I wept at this hello. It was a hello.
Wow.
Yeah, I would go back to that. Horace Silver. I took my father to hear Horace Silver while my father was still alive. And Horace played Song for My Father. I'd go back to that one with my father with me.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much. This has just been a real treat for
me. What a nice interview. Thank you so much, Larry.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Larry Slater, Sonoma County's Jazz MD, with Kathy Sloan, photographer and author of Keystone Corner, Portrait of a Jazz Club. Visit Kathy's website, kathysloanphotographer.com, where you can explore more of her photographic work. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang. When we come back, Larry talks with mystery writer Bill Moody. Bill Moody is a mystery author and professional jazz drummer who has played all over the world with such greats as Maynard Ferguson, John Hendricks, Annie Ross, and Lou Rawls. He spent 20 years playing music on the Vegas Strip before relocating to Northern California, where his career as a novelist and writing teacher took off. He's the author of 6 7 Horn Mysteries, and here he talks with Larry Slater.
Bill Moody is my guest today. Bill's a jazz drummer who has played or recorded with the likes of Maynard Ferguson, John Hendricks, and Lou Rawls. But Bill has found a second career as an author and the inventor of a new literary idiom, the jazz mystery. Bill Moody, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Bill, tell us a bit about your career both as a jazz musician and how you came to writing from jazz. I think you'd have to agree it is not the usual career path for a musician.
No, it's not. I know one other drummer, though, who did some writing, Dave Tough from old Chicago group. In fact, when he was on cruises to France, I was told he wrote limericks with F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Is that right?
And the King Edward VIII was on the ship a couple of times, and he let him set in on drums. And they asked Dave what kind of drummer would he make, and he said, well, he'd be a pretty good king, probably. That was it, you know. I was pretty self-taught. My mother was a pianist, and I used to set up my drums in the living room and play with her. And then I went to the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And at that time, Berklee was very small. It was only 400 or 500 students, and all of the teachers were still working musicians. As far as the writing, I wrote a column in the high school paper, and I was one of those guys that the teacher read my essays to the class. But and it just always came fairly easy for me. But I didn't really pursue it. But after I got on the road, I wrote some articles for Downbeat and some of the jazz magazines. And then when I went back to school, I did a paper on jazz and fiction. And I got a bunch of these books that were out of print and everything that was available. And most of it was pretty bad. You could tell the authors liked jazz, but they didn't really know a lot about it. So I thought, well, I can at least write about jazz from the inside. So I wrote a short story and it got published in a collection called Bebop B-Flat Scat. And it was short fiction and poetry. Then I wrote a couple of other stories, and somebody said, why don't you try a novel? You know, and I thought, well, maybe I could do that. And they said, you could make it a mystery, a jazz mystery novel. So I started looking around and realized there was a lot of material, a lot of mysterious events in jazz history that have never been solved. And that's what I did. And I started that one with the Wardell Gray story for Death of a Tenor Man.
But your protagonist is a fellow named Evan Horn, right?
Right.
But you're a drummer, and Evan Horn is a pianist.
Right.
Why is Evan Horn a pianist?
I didn't want Evan Horn to have to carry a set of drums around with him onto gigs. And I do play a little piano, not enough to scare anybody. And I figured that an audience would relate more to piano than to drums anyway. So I just saved Evan the trouble of lugging a set of drums around.
Did you have to learn about playing the piano?
My mother was quite a classical pianist, so I had the usual childhood piano lessons, which I took off and on, and then I fooled around on my own some. And so I could play chords and things, and I knew enough about it. And, I worked with enough piano players that any of them that I needed information from, I could get to. And the one thing I gave Evan was just as a part of his character was an injury before the first book starts. He's in an automobile crash and damages the tendons on his right hand or solo hand, and that was the title of the first book, Solo Hand. Because I had worked with a couple of pianists who were having problems with arthritis or various other muscular problems. So that was a whole area. So all through the books, I have Evan off and on getting better and getting, you know, and lapsing back. And a lot of readers at reading signings, they'll say, is, we hope Evan is better now. You know, and I said, yeah, he's getting better. Don't worry.
Bill, where do the ideas for your books come from? Obviously, you're steeped in jazz history. You've had the mysterious death of Chet Baker in Amsterdam, Wardell Gray, who was the tenor saxophonist in the 40s, who was found dead outside of Las Vegas. Where do the ideas come from? Oh, and you had a book on Clifford Brown as well.
Right. I start off just with a premise, and I don't know where I'm going to go with it, but with the Clifford Brown book's a good example of Sound of the Trumpet. I thought, what if somebody discovered some recordings that nobody had known about of Clifford Brown? And I picked Clifford Brown because he died so young. He was only 25. He died in a car crash, so there wasn't any mystery there. But he didn't record all that much compared to Miles Davis and Chet Baker, people like that. But I thought if they were discovered, how much would these tapes be worth? Who would want them? How valuable would they be? And so on. So that was the premise. And I started off, and I always intended for the recordings to be authentic. And I had Evan hired by somebody to authenticate the tapes, you know. And then about halfway through the book, I thought, well, what if these are not Clifford Brown? What if it's somebody imitating Clifford Brown? Why would they do that, and how would that affect things? Well, I went along with that, and it, I think, made the book better. And I found that I tried several musicians who said that yes, somebody could fool them into believing that this trumpet player was Clifford Brown. And there's a guy in San Diego, Charles McPherson, who was in the movie Bird, and he can fool anybody into thinking that he's Charlie Parker. But what was the most interesting part was I never talked to Clifford's widow, LaRue. I just didn't feel like I needed to, and her husband had been killed in a car crash, and I have a couple of scenes of that. But she called me after the book came out, and she said, I just wanted you to know I really enjoyed the book. And she said, but what I wanted to tell you is that we have found some tapes of Clifford Brown almost the same way you made it up in the book. And they had been discovered by another trumpet player, Bobby Shue, who lives in L.A. And he was talking to this guy who had a club in West Virginia, I think it was. And he said, oh, yeah, my grandfather ran this club, and he recorded everybody that came through. And he recorded so-and-so and so-and-so and Clifford Brown. And Bobby said, wait a minute. He recorded Clifford Brown? And he says, oh, yeah, and there was another guy with him, Sonny Rollins. And it was the whole Clifford Brown, Max Roach band on tour. Well, they found these tapes, and they were in very good condition. And Bobby sent me a copy of one of them. The sound quality was very good. And LaRue Brown told me that Blue Note planned to bring out a 2-CD set, the lost Clifford Brown tapes. But Max Roach held everything up. He wanted an enormous amount of money, and he prevented things, you know, happening when they should have. But I think eventually they will come out. It would be a shame for them not to, I think, you know.
Yeah, they'd be a real treasure. And, of course, we have had a few examples just in the last couple of years. There was the Charlie Parker thing that was found in a tape in a pawn shop somewhere up in Boston. So it's a good premise because it's real.
So that's what I do. And then with Chet Baker, there was all kinds of stories about what happened to Chet Baker. And by that time I was living up here, and a pianist I work with every week, Terry Henry, was very good friends with Chet Baker. And a singer I worked with occasionally, Marigold Hill, whenever Chet was up in this area, he stayed at her house. I was at her house one time, and I saw a photo on the mantle, and it was Chet and her, and it looked like her backyard. And she said, oh, yeah, Chet always stayed here when he came up. So I had all this personal information going on about Chet. And there were stories that he was pushed out of the window at this hotel in Amsterdam, or he fell off, or, you know, once I started, they were up, everybody says, oh, I know what really happened. And every time I hear somebody say that, I know they didn't, you know. So Russ Freeman gave me an awful lot of material because he was Chet's pianist for, I think, 7 or 8 years. And I went to Amsterdam, and I went to the hotel, and I went to in the back of the hotel where he supposedly fell out, and just checked the whole thing out. And like in the Wardell Gray case, I don't solve the mystery, but I put out all this information, and then I let the readers decide which is the most viable explanation.
Bill, one of the things I remember from that book, Looking for Chet Baker, was when Evan Horn, the protagonist, is coming back from Amsterdam, and he's driving up to Sonoma County and turns on the radio and gets a smooth jazz station, which will remain unnamed. And he goes, oh, my God, and he turns off the station. And then you follow that with a book called Bird Lives, where smooth jazz artists are being murdered. Yeah. And the murderer leaves a calling card, which is a bird feather, bird being the great alto saxophonist Charlie Parker. Mm-hmm. Obviously, many of us in the jazz world have very strong feelings about smooth jazz, and was this your way to express your feelings about smooth jazz, Bill?
Yeah, Bird Lives is probably the most popular book among musicians. The premise was, what if there's a serial killer killing smooth jazz musicians? As the book goes on, it's clear that it's not just about musical taste, and I couldn't actually use names like Kenny G, but everybody knows that's what we're talking about.
You know, in Bird Lives, you were dealing with our feelings about smooth jazz and how contemporary or mainstream jazz artists have such a difficult time making a living.
Mm-hmm.
So you moved now into your new book, which deals with jazz artists working in Hollywood and working with film scores. It seemed like a natural transition.
That's the newest one, called Fade to Blue. And the premise in that is, what if some big Tom Cruise-like movie star hired Evan to teach him how to look like he was playing piano for a movie role? How would that work out? And again, I didn't know how that was going to happen. And I had, you know, a little bit of rubbing shoulders with celebrity, especially during the time with Lou Rawls. And in fact, Steve McQueen lived across the street from him, and he used to come over and we'd play pool in Lou's basement playroom. He had a pool table and jukebox and all this stuff, and also a couple of other TV actors. And we worked, you know, opposite a lot of stars, too. So I knew what it would be like. And I thought the clash between Evan and an arrogant, big-time movie star could be interesting, and it turned out it was. And then, as you say, moving into scoring music for movies, I made that something that Evan thought he might not like to do. And that's how I end the book, with that scoring.
Bill, you've got a website where you draw some parallels between the improvisation in being a jazz musician and the improvising one does when one's writing a novel.
Yeah, there's a very strong connection with jazz. You have the framework of the tune you're playing, but you don't know what you're going to play until you get there. You know, and people say, "Well, how do you know to play that?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do until I get there." And with writing, you have the framework of a novel, and particularly with a mystery novel, you have a crime and you have suspects and you have some kind of resolution. So, and then what you do with it, you improvise on that, which is exactly what I do. A lot of writers, though, outline the entire book first, which I've never been able to do. I did try it once, and it just doesn't work for me. I find a strong connection between improvising on music and improvising with the writing. I had a little brief friendship with the writer Tony Hillerman, who wrote about the Navajo Indian detective Jim Chi and Joe Leaphorn, and he told me he never outlined either. I was very glad to hear that. And he said for each of his novels, he picked a premise of some level of Navajo custom or legend. And he says, then I get in my Jeep and I drive out on the reservation and I look for a place where the first body's going to be found. And then I go from there. So I was very pleased to hear that. But since I've been involved with writing, it's just been much more comfortable for me to do it without outlining it. Like I said, I changed the Clifford Brown book halfway through it because it suddenly struck me that maybe this would be a different way to go.
So you start at the beginning with a concept, mm-hmm. and you don't know what the resolution is going to be, as opposed to coming up with a resolution and then coming backwards to build the story.
Yeah, exactly. All I know is how I'm going to start. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But so far it's worked. And it's, like Hillerman called it, a discovery draft of the book. And he said he likened it to driving in the fog. You can see 100 feet or so ahead of you, and then you get to that point, and then you can see another 100 feet. So that's pretty much how I go, too. It's like when you're playing. You play the first chorus, and then you can look ahead to the next chorus, and then at some point there's going to be a bass solo, and then exchanges for the drums, and so you can see a little bit ahead each time, and that's how it's always been with me.
And our readers don't know that Evan Horn, the protagonist, has a CIA agent girlfriend.
Well, FBI, actually.
FBI, that's
right. Yeah, FBI. Right. He met her during Bird Lives. She was a profiler, since they were dealing with a serial killer. And they developed into a relationship, and they're still together now. And he had previously been involved with another Santa Monica policewoman, and they broke up. And a couple of times at readings, some women got very mad because they were upset that Evan had broken up with Natalie, the cop, and taken off with this FBI agent. You know, in fact, at one time during a reading where I was sitting, there was a shelf, and I could hear these two women arguing on the other side, and they said, Evan would never have done that. They were just really going at it, and I thought, well, that's pretty cool because these are totally fictional characters. So he is still with Andy Lawrence, the FBI agent now.
Bill, is there a historical precedent here? I can't think of a jazz musician who's had a significant other in law enforcement.
Yeah, I have one of the characters in the Chet Baker book, Fletcher Page, the older musician that he says to Evan at one point, he says, man, you got a friend in the cops, your girlfriend is an FBI, so I never heard of a musician with so many law enforcement people connected to him, so it works because Andy can help him with if he gets in trouble with federal involvement, and his friend Cooper can help him with local stuff. Evan is not an official private detective, so he's not supposed to know all these police procedures.
And Evan does always seem to be in trouble.
That's been the tricky line why would a jazz musician get involved in so many things like this? Plausibility has always been a big thing for me. I've read so many books where they offer somebody to do something and they just say, okay, and there's no reason for them to do this, So I usually have it as starting off with Evan is doing a favor for somebody and then gets in over his head. And like the Clifford Brown, he's hired just to listen to these tapes and say whether he thinks they really are Clifford Brown or not. And everything escalates off of that.
Bill, with your careers, you've been a jazz musician, a jazz drummer most of your life, and an author for several years. You had a radio show in Las Vegas, you told me, and now you have one in Sonoma, and you taught creative writing at Sonoma State. Tell us a little bit about that, and let me know if you think that the act of coming up with jazz mysteries has been able to introduce a younger generation to jazz.
I think in some cases it has. I mean, I get emails occasionally from around the world. In fact, there was one woman who did her master's thesis on my books, and this English writer friend of mine sent me a copy of her thesis, and it was called Cool Cats in the Mean Streets. She totally analyzed all the books, and I was amazed at some of the stuff that she came up with. I don't know of anybody other writer who's writing about jazz from the inside with a major character being a jazz musician. There are several writers who have jazz in their books, but having Evan as the protagonist has, I think, separated my books from the herd, you know, at least. But I'm still what's known in publishing as a niche writer or mid-list writer, unless the Chet Baker book's been optioned for a film. And if that ever happens, then it will change the whole picture of things.
Bill, are all your books in print? And if so, where would people find them?
Yeah, they're all in print. They're certainly on all over on Amazon and at bookstores. There's Reader's Books in Sonoma. I always do reading there. They carry them. Barnes & Noble in Santa Rosa has got them, or they can get them. So they're all out there. And you might have to look for them a little harder than you would for Stephen King or John Grisham.
And if somebody wanted to start on the Evan Horn mystery series, which book would you recommend they begin with?
Some people prefer to start from the beginning with Solo Hand, but it doesn't really matter. You can pick any of them out. And I usually make reference to previous books at some point in the book, so it doesn't really matter which one you start, as long as you start with one of them.
So they each stand on their own.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Moody, thanks so much for sharing your life journey. Bill, would you be interested in telling your readers about your radio show?
Sure.
Do you podcast it? Do you stream it?
It is streamed. I'm on KSVY in Sonoma Thursday nights from 10 to midnight. And the show's called Stolen Moments in Jazz. I'd sort of described it as bebop and beyond.
And I think it is true that the Bay Area, if one wants to explore the world of jazz, there is no better area than the Bay Area. We have a 24-hour jazz station in KCSM, KRCB. We have Jazz Connections every Saturday from 8 to midnight. Bill Moody's on Sonoma. And, of course, we have some of the best jazz clubs in San Francisco. And we have the Healdsburg Jazz Festival every year. So tune in if you want to get exposed to jazz and pick up a Bill Moody book. Bill, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Larry Slater, the Jazz MD, for being our guest host today. You can hear Larry's four-hour retrospective on South African jazz broadcast on KCSM Jazz 91 at kcsm.org on April 25th from 2 to 6. Join KRCB every Sunday afternoon at 4 for more literary programming here on the New 91. You can listen to us anytime on iTunes. Subscribe to our podcast. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening.